In July of this year, the East Turkestan National Awakening Movement found 193 prisons, 124 concentration camps, and 66 labor camps using satellite imagery. And we estimated that there's at least 3.6 million people being detained.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square, and thanks for joining us to discuss a timely topic, Chinese democracy in crisis, the new Long March. As per usual, we're right deep in there examining the recent events in Hong Kong, previously a popular tourist destination, an international trading nexus, and now a political hotspot. Until April of this year, Hong Kong had operated somewhat autonomously under Chinese control. A 50-year mandate was granted to Hong Kong in 1997 when the British left, and for the last 20 years, residents in the region were typically calm and law-abiding. Well, all that changed suddenly in April 2019, and chaos erupted on the streets. Ever since, Hong Kong has been the site of increasingly strident demonstrations by pro-democracy supporters, many of whom are students. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we're going to discuss the situation in Hong Kong, which provides a litmus test for the Chinese government's response to protesters' demands for democratic reform. In addition, we are going to examine the persecution and detention of 3 million Muslim Uyghurs within mainland China. And finally, we will consider the long-term foreign policy objectives of the Chinese government. Tonight, we are fortunate to have with us three human rights activists, each of whom is equipped to address different aspects of Chinese domestic and foreign policy. We're honored to welcome Kyle Olbert, Director of Operations for the East Turkestan National Awakening Movement, Teng Bao, a human rights lawyer and adjunct professor at the City University of New York, and finally, Ambassador Salih Hudayar, who's a Uyghur American in exile and who escaped severe oppression in China to found a group called Etnam in 2017. It's my great pleasure to introduce Kyle Olbert.
As Mary mentioned, the topic this evening is China and China's new Long March. The Long March was a series of strategic military retreats undertaken by Communist China's Red Army, a precursor to today's People's Liberation Army, as they attempted to evade Chinese KMT nationalist forces. Today we see a different Long March, a strategic retreat by China from the liberal, rules-based international order. Let me preface this by stating emphatically that the Chinese people and the Chinese government are different things. The Chinese people are some of the brightest, most industrious, most loving, and beautiful people that I have ever met. And so I want to make certain that whenever I speak tonight about China, you all clearly understand that I am leveling these criticisms at the Chinese government and not at the Chinese people. The first threat that I'd like to discuss concerns espionage. As somebody who works on human rights issues related to China, this is actually a bigger concern for me than some of you might expect. Almost every week I hear reports from persecuted people who say that they or their families have been targeted by Chinese intelligence operatives. The population that I work with, which is mainly made up of Uyghurs, an ethnically Turkic people whom China is imprisoning in concentration camps, prisons, and labor camps, which Sally will discuss later, are perhaps the population that is most targeted by Chinese intelligence outside of China's traditional state adversaries, namely the United States. In the past 3 years, there have been several alarming instances of U.S. government employees betraying their country in order to act as agents of a foreign power, namely China. There was the case of ex-CIA officer Kevin Mallory, who was just sentenced to 20 years for selling classified defense information to the Chinese. Then there's a case of Jerry Chunxing Li, who recently pled guilty to conspiring to deliver national defense information to a foreign government. And he is awaiting sentence, last I checked. So this is truly a whole of government problem that the United States is facing. But on the topic of Uyghurs, last week, it was announced that China had infected some 11 Uyghur websites with malware. So that should give you an idea of how high of a priority the Chinese place on targeting minority populations, dissidents, and the like. But this case is emblematic of a much larger issue: China's usage of next-generation cyber warfare capabilities, in other words, hacking, for collecting intelligence. These are capabilities that China uses to great effect against American companies in order to steal intellectual property. In fact, China's intellectual property theft cost the U.S. economy between $225 billion to $600 billion annually, according to the Commission on the Theft of American Intellectual Property. In July, FBI Director Wray stated that the FBI currently has some 1,000 ongoing investigations into Chinese intellectual property theft. And we aren't talking about minor theft. We aren't talking about pirating movies or stealing music or selling knockoff Louis Vuitton bags. We're talking about serious theft. For instance, in 2014, the Department of Justice charged nine Chinese nationals with engaging in several successful hacking attempts against U.S. companies on behalf of the People's Liberation Army. One of those companies was Westinghouse, the American company which designs nuclear reactors. Alleged in the Department of Justice's 2014 indictment is the hair-raising charge that technical and design specifications were among the materials stolen. In other words, China has literally stolen our nuclear know-how. And that's not all that China's government has stolen. It has stolen American jobs, and this is a point on which both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders will agree, and plenty of people in between them. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the trade deficit that came with China's 2001 ascension to the World Trade Organization has cost the United States some 3.4 million jobs. Of course, all of these things are small potatoes if war breaks out between China and the United States. That's the real risk. And the risk is more real than ever in the South China Sea. The South China Sea is a key commercial thoroughfare which connects Asia, Europe, Africa, and the rest of the world. And its seabed is rich in mineral resources, like oil and gas. A third of global shipping, or some $3.37 trillion, transits through the South China Sea. The root of the problem in the South China Sea stems from the fact that some six countries assert various different, sometimes overlapping, territorial claims. The Philippines, Vietnam, China, Brunei, Taiwan, and Malaysia all base these territorial claims on various accounts of history and geography. These differences have been handled mostly well until 2014, when China began a massive dredging operation to build artificial islands there in the South China Sea, which they promptly began militarizing in order to assert control over the 1.3 million square miles of territory that they had claimed there. According to the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, which is part of Washington's Center for Strategic and International Studies, satellite images show that the Chinese have built missile shelters and radar and communications facilities on at least three of the artificial islands there, in contradiction to the pledge that Chinese President Xi Jinping made in 2015 to President Obama. More recently, the Chinese have even tested a ship killer missile from the man-made structures on those islands. This is a missile that could conceivably sink one of our aircraft carriers. The problem that we face with China is a very, very hard one. But more importantly, it's one that has real human cost. The next two speakers can both attest to that. And so without further ado, I would like to introduce to you Mr. Ting Bao, who is a world-renowned human rights expert and a human rights lawyer who escaped from China via Hong Kong. Ting.
Thank you, Cal. When I was in China, I defended Christians, Falun Gong practitioners, and other persecuted religious groups, political dissidents, Tibetans, and Uyghurs, victims of forced abortion and forced demolition, victims of torture and all kinds of injustice. I wrote articles to criticize the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party. I organized protests against corruption and unfair trial. I attended meetings commemorating Tiananmen Massacre. Definitely, the Chinese government does not tolerate any kind of challenges to its monopoly of power. I was disbarred and prevented from traveling internationally. I was banned from teaching by the university. I was put under house arrest from time to time. My wife and my children were also targeted. I was mentally and physically tortured. On the night of February 19, 2011, the secret police covered me in a black hood, handcuffed me, and threw me in a black car, took me to a black jail. I was forced to wear handcuffs 24/7, stay in one position. They put me under an extreme form of solitary confinement for 70 days, adding punches and face slapping. I was a visiting scholar in Hong Kong in 2014, witnessing and participating in the waves of demonstrations demanding the universal suffrage of Hong Kong people. The universal suffrage has been promised by Beijing, and it was articulated in the Sino-British Joint Declaration and Hong Kong Basic Law. But after Hong Kong's handover to China in 1997, the Chinese government broke its promises, its international commitment again and again. In August 2014, Chinese government issued a white paper, actually destroyed the one country, two systems formula. And then it crossed the umbrella movement. And then Chinese secret police kidnapped publishers and booksellers in Hong Kong and Thailand. They also kidnapped a billionaire in Hong Kong. The Hong Kong government, Beijing's puppet authority, disqualified pro-democracy Congress members, banned a pro-independent party, and proposed an extradition bill, which will put every Hong Konger's safety in danger. Hong Kong people know well about the mainland China's judicial system. It's like a combination of torture, corruption, forced confession, and show trials. Since June this year, millions of Hong Kong people went out to the street protesting against this extradition bill. But what the authorities responded to the demands was tear gas, rubber bullets, beanbags, mass arrests, mafia attacks, humiliation, and demonization. People are worrying about the possibility of another Tiananmen massacre in Hong Kong. People living in China do not have access to Google, Facebook, or Twitter, nor do they have the right to protect their houses or land. They do not have religious freedom or the right to vote. Forced disappearance, torture, secret police, corruption, actual legal detentions, and forced demolitions have all been rampant. Since Xi Jinping came to power, the human rights situation has been hugely deteriorating. He initiated the comprehensive crackdown on human rights lawyers, NGOs, internet scholars, underground churches, Tibetans, and Uyghurs. In East Turkestan, at least 2 million people have been arbitrarily detained in the concentration camps. With its economic rise and the technological development, China has accelerated its march towards an advanced version of 1984. I name it as high-tech totalitarianism. The Chinese Communist Party utilizes its lead in artificial intelligence to make its control of Chinese society even more total. China's Great Firewall, social media, big data, e-commerce, and modern telecommunications make it easier for the CCP to keep people under severe surveillance. The internet has been used by the CCP as an effective tool for censorship, propaganda, and brainwashing. China's public surveillance camera network will keep growing with some 2.76 billion units slated to be installed by 2022. CCP has built a regime which is an opposition to liberal democracy. It is high time for the democratic countries to stop their engagement policy towards China in the name of appeasement policy. Thank you.
And next, I would like to introduce Saleh Hudayar, who is the ambassador to the United States from the East Turkestan government in exile, as well as the founder of the East Turkestan National Awakening Movement.
Today is the 18th anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks, and I'd like to talk about the current terrorism that is being perpetrated by China's government against the people of East Turkestan. Some 3 million or more Uyghurs and other Turkic peoples are currently being incarcerated in concentration camps under the pretext of counterterrorism. Terrorism is not the real problem, and it's not the real reason why. Firstly, this region, like Tibet, was an independent nation prior to Communist China occupying it in 1949. China has since renamed it to Xinjiang, which means the new territory, and this is the root of the problem. Since China colonized this region, occupied this region, it began a campaign of colonization. First, it purged a lot of intellectuals, businessmen, including my own great-grandfather, who I'm named after. He was killed for being a capitalist by the communist regime. Then throughout, over the years, China began to conduct nuclear tests in East Turkestan. From 1964 to 1996, some 46 nuclear tests were conducted, in which roughly 800,000 people were killed, and millions were exposed to various cancerous diseases as a result of radiation. Between 1979 to 2009, the Chinese Communist government has stated that it has prevented 3.7 million births in East Turkestan as part of its family planning policy. Following the fall of the Soviet Union and the independence of West Turkestan, China launched the Strike Hard campaign in 1996 because it feared East Turkestan independence sentiment. In 1997, tens of thousands of East Turkestanis demonstrated in Gulja. The demonstration was brutally suppressed, with hundreds killed and thousands arrested. During 1997 to 1998, over 100,000 people were arrested for political crimes, including my uncle. And this is my first interaction with the Chinese Communist regime. In the middle of the night, they raided our home because my uncle had read a book about religion. And to get him to confess to his political crimes, they woke up everybody, and including myself, I was the youngest in the home. I was only 4 years old at the time. They pointed a gun to my head and threatening to kill me if my uncle didn't confess to his crimes. So in order to save my life, my uncle confessed to being a part of some non-existent organization and was sentenced to many years in prison. 2 weeks prior to 9/11, China's government claimed that this region, that East Turkestan, was peaceful and there was no unrest. However, right after 9/11, China claimed that it was a victim of terrorism. And shortly after, they launched a brutal campaign to suppress East Turkestani slash Uyghur identity, culture, language, and our religious practices. In 2014, China launched the Strike Hard and Securitization campaign, in which they installed millions of CCTV cameras across the region, put up thousands of checkpoints, and began the mass arrests of what would lead to 3 million people as we speak, according to the Department of Defense, being locked up in concentration camps. Officially, in 2016, China launched its re-education and transformation campaign. China declared East Turkestanis enemies of the state and the people. Hundreds of prisons, concentration camps, and labor camps were built across the region. Millions of people were arrested solely on their ethnic, Turkic ethnic identity and their religion. It's fitting that we're discussing this on 9/11 because China is justifying this brutal crimes against humanity in the name of counterterrorism. From 2016 to 2017, according to Chinese state media Xinhua, some 36 million people's DNAs, voice prints, and retina scans were collected across East Turkestan. What's even more disturbing was in 2017, the People's Liberation Army's biowarfare strategy recommended that China develop genetic ethnic-specific attacks against China's enemies. In July of this year, the East Turkestan National Awakening Movement, after conducting a project for several months, we found 193 prisons, 124 concentration camps, and 66 labor camps using satellite imagery. And we estimated that there's at least 3.6 million people being detained. Inside the camps, China's putting people into forced indoctrination, political indoctrination, where they're forced to renounce their ethnic religious identity. They're forced undergoing forced medication, sterilization, forced starvation, rape, and even organ harvesting. Outside of the camps, some 500,000 children have been separated from their families and sent to state-run orphanages and boarding schools where they are raised as loyal Chinese citizens. China is shutting down and bulldozing religious sites, mosques and churches, and even graveyards are not being spared. Reports from Radio Free Asia stated that China is building crematoria across the region. China is offering huge incentives, including free housing and sign-up bonus in cash, and even a Turkic wife to Han Chinese settlers who settle in what it calls its new territory. Forced marriages of Uyghur and Turkic women to Han Chinese men are part of China's state policy. What is happening is a genocide, and it hasn't yet been recognized as a genocide by the international community. But in the UN Genocide Conventions, everything that I mentioned here follows under their definition of genocide. The real reason here is not terrorism, as China claims it to be, but rather an effort to eradicate the separate ethnic and national identity held by the people of East Turkestan. In July 2019, China announced a white paper and a national defense strategy. In the white paper, they claimed that East Turkestan never existed and that the Uyghurs were actually Chinese and not Turkic. China's national defense strategy listed one of its top national priority defense goals is to prevent the creation of East Turkestan. Thus, why I founded Etnam was to raise awareness about the situation, because existing organizations only focused on the human rights aspect and didn't focus on the political aspect. And we believe that if we do not have our political rights, there is no way that we can guarantee and safeguard our human rights or our other freedoms. Thus, the main point that I want to leave here with is that the United States government and the international community need to uphold the UN Genocide Convention and recognize what China is doing as a genocide, and to act immediately through sanctions, through diplomatic demarches, and other means to prevent a 21st century Holocaust. Thank you.
Well, before we open up the questions to the audience, I'm just going to ask a couple of questions of our three experts here. I think that was quite a staggering amount of appalling information, which I have to say seems to be withheld from the Western media. Until I saw a BBC report about 6 weeks ago about the actual camps themselves, which one reporter managed to get into, it was remarkable, the song and dance routine they put on for them. People dancing around, frolicking, enjoying themselves. They said, well, where are the recreational places? Are people allowed outside? Oh, yes, they have wonderful games and they do basketball. And So within 24 hours, their satellite pictures of these camps had changed, and these miraculous athletic facilities appeared within about 24 hours. What I can't believe is how this has been kept. With all our technology and satellite coverage, how is it that this has been kept from the Western human rights organizations? Nobody seems to be doing anything about it.
Well, one of the reasons is that, you know, Western governments are largely, most governments across the world are heavily intertwined with China economically, so they don't want to upset China in fear of, having an economic backlash or disrupting economic relations with China. So they are remaining silent on this issue. As far as why human rights organizations are not able to go into the region is another story, because of this severe secretization program that China has. Every 500 meters, there's checkpoints, and the journalists that have been able to go there, many of them have been harassed, many of their footages have been deleted, and many have been even deported.
It was interesting that you raised the Tiananmen Square point. I remember meeting a teenager who had been in China because his parents were there for 3 years. And he said that there was no mention on the internet anywhere of anything having occurred in Tiananmen Square. When you did a search in China, it didn't happen. So that's one thing, is that history is being rewritten. And then the other thing is, I was always appalled that America, at the very same time this was going on, was making China most favored nation. So do you think the American government have some responsibility for this appeasement and ignoring of what was actually going on to further purely economic gain?
Yeah. You know, it's very interesting to me that you mentioned the issue of censorship of Tiananmen Square, because that's not simply the case in China. You now find that Western tech companies are censoring things along the Chinese Communist Party line as well. For instance, with Tiananmen Square, I would challenge all of the viewers, all of the audience members, go to the Google search engine and type in Tiananmen Square. Then go to Google Translate, type in Tiananmen Square, get the Chinese translation back, go back to Google, copy and paste the Chinese translation of Tiananmen Square into Google. Okay? And what you're going to see in the English results and in the Chinese results are two completely different things. In the English results, you'll see pictures of Tank Man. In the Chinese results, you won't. And this is the level of authoritarian influence that is being exerted over the Western free world through this entanglement that Sully talked about. You know, this economic entanglement and interdependency that we have with China. So to your second question about most favored nation status, I do think this was probably the worst mistake that America has made in the past several decades with regard to China, because we did not condition that most favored nation trading status, now it's called PNTR, Permanent Normalized Trade Relations, on China's adherence to basic fundamental human rights policies. We see the effects of this today. We see it in Hong Kong. We see it in East Turkestan. We see it throughout China. I mean, China is literally becoming a prison for 1.34 billion people.
Thank you very much. Really was an education to hear everything you had to say. You have been listening to Chinese Democracy in Crisis. Cambridge Forum is sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and First Parish Church in Cambridge. Thanks for joining us. Spread the word, and please visit us again.